We'll get going. We have a quorum. I'll start the Environment, Energy, Natural Resources Committee this morning. I believe we have Mr. Meyer and Deputy Commissioner Shad. I think I saw both of them here. They're going to do an overview for us on the DNR's land. They're coming down, and then members, maybe I'll just talk a little bit about we're going to do it today. We have a couple bills that we're going to hear for informational purposes that'll coincide with Deputy Commissioner Shad and Mr. Meyer's presentations. And then tomorrow we're going to have the first of our agency budget presentations. It'll be by Bowser. And then on Thursday, we're going to have an in-depth discussion on part of the DNR land situation, and that'll deal mostly with the school trust land. Also, we'll hear Representative Paul Anderson's got a bill to encourage some work on the existing DNR lands by utilizing some, making sure we're using the private sector to help us there. And the discussion on the school trust land will center around some bills that Representative Dietrich is carrying. I believe there's probably three different bills that deal. One of them has to deal with what's commonly referred to as a Utah model. It's a little different model for the managing of school trust lands. So, Deputy Commissioner, welcome. If you want to identify yourself and then go ahead. We'll let you, I think, go through your presentation, and then at the end of your presentation we'll take questions, unless members you get a burning one that you're perplexed or we forgot to put some papers or something in the packet. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, members. For the record, Dave Shad, DNR Deputy Commissioner, and we're going to walk through fairly quickly here an analysis that we did of costs and needs associated with our public land base. I think you're going to get a presentation a little later on the legislative auditor report on public lands that was done 2 years ago. One of the recommendations in that report was that DNR prepare a long-range budget analysis of management needs and an analysis of feasibility of long-range land acquisition plans. The legislature took up that recommendation and actually directed us to do that analysis, and we delivered that report here about January 1st, and so that's what I'll be walking through here this morning. First of all, I think just a little bit of background.
Deputy
about
Commissioner. This is a common occurrence in this committee that the chairman doesn't always look at the agenda, and I just want to check with the legislative auditor. Director Noble, you were first on the agenda. Are you a Deputy Commissioner, what is yours, like a 15-20-minute deal?
At the most, and I think it would make more sense to have the auditor's report before we get into this, because some of the findings are directly related to
it. Doesn't surprise me, Deputy Commissioner, that I screwed it up. So why don't we turn your overhead off?
All right.
And Director Noble, if you could come and identify yourself, and I apologize to the committee. Representative Torkelson would like to move the minutes. Discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Nay. Motion carries. Director Noble.
Mr. Chairman and members, for the record, my name is Jim Nobles. I'm the legislative auditor, and with me is John Yunker, who is the manager of our report on land management, which we issued last year. And, Mr. Chairman, I'm always comfortable with whatever order you want to take. I'm just happy always to be before your committee. As was mentioned, we issued this report on an issue that is kind of perennially controversial, because the fact that the state and the public generally owns a lot of land in Minnesota is both seen as an opportunity and a great resource for the people, but also it gives rise to a number of controversies as well. And so our report addressed a number of those, covered a variety of issues, gave you just a lot of descriptive information about public land ownership in Minnesota. We also had a chapter that looked at conservation easements, which is a developing way for the public to achieve a number of benefits without actually owning land. But then I think we really got to a couple of the more controversial issues, and they related to the financial implications of land ownership, and there are many. And one of the most specific ones that we covered, and it becomes quite complex, is the issue related to the state making payments to certain local units of government in lieu of taxes. So we covered a lot of ground, Mr. Chairman, but I think the theme of that report was already just touched on with the fact that the legislature asked DNR to produce the report that then you're going to hear after our presentation, because we really felt that the state needed to bring the acquisition and ownership of land more in line with our resources to actually manage the land. And we thought that DNR needed to provide you with more detailed, in-depth information about the gap that exists between those two objectives of both acquiring and owning land and the resources to manage them. Because as we did our evaluation, went around and talked to a lot of the program people in DNR, we found that there was a significant gap and that that needed to be explored and analyzed in greater depth, and that information needed to be shared with the legislature. And that is the report that DNR is going to present to you. But before we get to that, Mr. Chairman, maybe we ought to talk a little more about how we got to that recommendation and how we came to recommend that DNR produce the report. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Junker to make the presentation, and thank you again.
Well, thank you, Director Nobles. And Mr. Junker, welcome, if you could identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm John Junker. I was the project manager for our study of natural resource land. As Mr. Noble said, we covered a number of issues in this study. One of the issues was whether or not DNR, or how DNR has reviewed its existing land holdings to see whether there was land that they could sell or exchange or benefit from by holding other land rather than the land it held. Secondly, we looked at the management of easements, both by DNR and by the Board of Water and Soil Resources. And we looked at, in DNR, this bigger issue that's going to be talked about by DNR later today, whether or not DNR had adequate resources to manage and maintain existing land holdings, as well as to manage the easements that they hold. And finally, we looked at whether the level of payments to local governments, what's called payments in lieu of taxes, in recognition which is a recognition that holding state land has some impact on those local governments. We looked at whether or not those payments were adequate or appropriate. What we found was that DNR has made some efforts to strategically evaluate its land holdings, but we felt that there, in a number of ways, more work was needed. We also found that DNR lacked a comprehensive easement management program, but was in the process of developing one. Thirdly, we found that DNR appears to lack adequate resources to manage and maintain land, and we recommended that the legislature require DNR to prepare the report that you're going to hear about later today. And finally, we said that the adequacy of payments in lieu of taxes is really difficult to assess, and that's partly due to the fact that it's not clear what exactly the purpose of the payments in lieu of taxes is, and it's also due to the fact that there are some things here that are very difficult to measure. But what we said was that if you look at acquired non-hunting land, it would appear that counties receive more than is necessary to offset the lost property tax revenue that occurs when land is acquired. And again, that only applies to non-hunting land. Just a little bit of background about the DNR land holdings and other public natural resource land holdings in the state. About 1/6 of the land in the state, or 8.4 million acres, is state-owned. About 2/3 of that, 5.6 million acres, is managed by DNR. about 2.8 billion acres is tax forfeited land that is technically held by the state, but it's held in trust for local governments and it's managed by the counties. Now, if we focus only on DNR's land holdings at 5.6 million acres, more than two-thirds of that is forestry land. Another big share, almost a quarter, is wildlife management areas. And parks and state parks and recreation areas only account for about 4% of the land, scientific and natural areas, 3%, and the rest of the DNR land holdings, 1% of their total. It's important to kind of recognize what type of land this is. Only about a quarter of all of the land is truly acquired land. 45% of the land is trust fund land, most of that being school trust fund land that was given to the state back around the time of statehood by the federal government. Little more than a quarter of the land is consolidated conservation land. That's land that the counties back in the 1920s and 1930s, seven counties in particular, tried to make more viable for agriculture, and they issued bonds to make some drainage improvements, and they were unsuccessful. They were in danger of defaulting on the bonds, and the deal that was struck was that the state would take over those lands in return for paying off the bonds. The state does share revenues on some of those lands with local governments. If you look over the longer term, like the last 20 years, there's been modest growth in DNR land holdings, only about a 5% growth over the last 20 years. Most of that growth has been in the acquisition of wildlife areas, scientific and natural areas, and state parks. There's actually been a small reduction in the amount of forest land that we hold. The tax forfeited land, that's the 2.8 million acres that's held in trust for local governments and managed by counties, there's been little change in the amount of that land over the last 20 years. You know, in doing this study, it's looking at DNR, it's apparent DNR has some competing pressures on it. It has considerable pressures to buy land and acquire easement for a variety of purposes. And I'm going to go to the next slide and then come back to this one. If you look at DNR's long-range acquisition plans, these are plans that either DNR has put together or DNR in combination with citizen advisory groups has put together. These plans show that, you know, we're thinking about acquiring an enormous amount of additional land. For example, a 64% increase over a period of decades for wildlife management areas, a 240% increase in scientific natural areas. So these long-range plans have some very ambitious goals. As I said before, there are also pressures on DNR to sell land. Back in, I think it was 2003 and 2005, there were a number of requirements in state law that the state sell land and that money be used to go back to the general fund to address the budget deficits. I think we're still working on that 2005 requirement, and there's an expectation that DNR is going to be able to sell some land to meet that goal. There also are concerns from counties about the fiscal impacts of land ownership and about their impact on economic development plans. There is non-income producing land in the BWCA, which some folks would like to exchange with the federal government, although there's a lot of controversy, exchange with the federal government so that we can get some federal land that could produce some income for the state. And then finally, if you look at the forestry holdings of DNR and of the county-managed tax-forfeited land and even private or other holdings, you look at the pattern of ownership, there's a checkerboard pattern of ownership that, you know, the efficiency of management could be improved if we did land exchanges to improve and consolidate the land holdings of the state and of the counties and others. First issue I said we looked at was DNR's efforts to evaluate land holdings, and we believe that they've made an effort to try to strategically look at their land holdings, and they've identified some land for sale, and they put it up for sale. At the time we were doing the study, and that was just a little less than a year ago that we released this report, DNR was conducting a pilot project with Roseau County, looking at the land holdings in that county that DNR had, the county's land holdings, and trying to come up with some mutually acceptable alternatives that would address some of the concerns the county had about DNR land holdings. And just before we issued the report last year, DNR had finalized some forestry plans where they looked at all of their forestry holdings and looked at what opportunities there were for acquisitions, sales, and exchanges. So that was just kind of at the, they were kind of at the end of the planning process and had not implemented any of that. We felt that DNR's work needed to continue in this area, that we still had not met that 2005 goal of selling land, that the checkerboard pattern of public forest ownership still existed, but the DNR plans were, you know, trying to get at that, so hopefully they would work on that. Again, the BWA situation still exists, and that's not all DNR's fault, because, you know, you have to negotiate with the federal government, and there are all sorts of other parties that have varying views on that as well. And finally, we felt that there were additional counties that we had talked with, particularly in northern Minnesota, that were very interested in participating in projects like Roseau County had. The second issue that we looked at was the conservation easement issue. Conservation easements are a way of preserving land by limiting certain development or other rights of the private landowner. But even though the state doesn't own the land, if you own an easement, it requires some initial and ongoing diligence by the DNR or by other public agencies who are involved to protect the public investment. And that means you try to maintain an inventory of investment of easements. You do a baseline report on the condition of the property when you acquire that easement, so you know what's there, and then you can track what changes, or if it should have changed. If the easement prohibits change, you know what was there initially. And then you do periodic monitoring enforcement to make sure that the landowner is complying with the terms of the easement. In looking at the easement programs at the Board of Water and Soil Resources and DNR, we felt that one agency had a comprehensive plan. That was the Board of Water and Soil Resources. But we felt that DNR did not have an agency-wide program. And it had managed, you know, within its various divisions, had managed some easements better than others. DNR was in the process of developing a comprehensive plan with the help from a legislative grant that came up through the LCCMR. And so they were in the process of compiling an inventory with it, which they lacked, and also developing policies for baseline reports and monitoring. The third issue we looked at in this report was the issue of whether DNR had adequate resources to manage and maintain existing land holdings. We felt that DNR lacked adequate resources, although, you know, that our conclusion came from talking to various divisions and managers in that in DNR. And we were unable to come up with kind of an overall figure for how much they were short on funds. But what we could see was that there was some initial development work of land that they acquired but hadn't been developed. There was deferred rehabilitation work on land they owned. And there was inadequate funding in a number of areas for periodic maintenance or operations. So at the same time that DNR was acquiring land, they were kind of adding to the inventory of problems because they couldn't keep up with maintaining the land that they already owned. What we suggested was, what we recommended was that DNR should prepare a long-range budget analysis that compares ongoing funding needs to existing funding levels. And we recommended that the legislature require DNR to do that. The legislature last year did. And we also suggested that once that report was produced, that it's going to need some oversight. The legislature needed to look at those analyses and how DNR was defining its needs, too, because I think that's an area that needs some scrutiny. And we also felt that they were a little farther off in the area of wildlife management areas because they hadn't yet even quantified their overall management needs. Hopefully they've done that through the process they went through, but it was just a comment that compared to other areas, they were farther off. We felt that these long-range budget analyses would help the legislature better understand the ongoing costs of land ownership and help the legislature balance funding for acquisition with fundings for ongoing management and maintenance. The final issue that we looked at in this report was the area of payments in lieu of taxes. And in 2009, the state paid about $22 million in PILT. Most of it was distributed to counties and townships, but because acquired hunting lands, are subject to a different law, an older law, they're distributed to counties, townships, and school districts. Payment rates for state land, for PILT, vary a lot, and I'll show you in the next slide how they vary. But they're the highest for lands that were on the tax rolls when they were acquired, or for certain consolidated conservation lands that are in state parks or recreation areas, scientific and natural areas, and for wildlife management areas. If we're talking about acquired land, the PILT payment is either the greater of $5.11 per acre or 0.75% of appraised value. If we're talking about other DNR administered land, the payment is 64 cents per acre. It's a much lower payment, and you know, I can't say whether that's the right amount or right difference, but it's a lower payment in recognition of the fact that those lands were not acquired by the state. They were given to the state by the federal government, and they were never on the tax rolls. Tax forfeited land, again, that's the land that the counties manage, receives $1.28 per acre. Part of the problem we had in addressing this question of the adequacy or the appropriateness of the level of PILT payments is state law doesn't provide much guidance on the purpose of PILT. So how are we going to measure whether PILT is the right amount? But when you think about it, probably PILT is intended to offset the fiscal impacts of state land ownership on local governments. Well, that's a good idea, but the problem with that is there are lots of potential fiscal impacts. The first that comes to mind is if this is acquired land, then the local jurisdictions have lost some property tax revenue because now it's state-owned and it's not paying property tax. That's probably the biggest and the one you can most easily look at. But it could be argued that if you acquire state land, that might have an impact on adjacent land. Some would argue that it would increase the value of adjacent land. It may or may not. There's also a potential impact on local government services, and that could be positive or negative, as depending on what the alternative use was of the land that was acquired. There are also some increased state aids that may be paid to counties, cities, and school districts if land is acquired. So you've got to think about that there's revenues coming to these jurisdictions besides PILT, and we talk about that in our report and provide some information, some numbers on that. And then also you need to consider that there are revenues generated from tax forfeited or consolidated conservation land. If it has timber on it, that timber is managed and sold, and there are some net revenues that go to the local jurisdictions. And then finally, there are economic impacts from state land They could be either positive, they bring in tourists, or they could be negative in that the alternative would be economic development of some sort that would generate more revenues and have a better economic impact on local governments. So it's a very complicated area and one that I think would be very difficult to develop a complete answer on. What we did was, as I said, we looked at the impact on other state aids, and that's in the report, and I'm not going to talk about it today very much. But what we specifically did was looked at acquired land, and we tried to compare PILT, the amount of PILT, that's that higher payment of 5.11 per acre or 0.75% of the appraised value. We tried to compare PILT to the estimated property taxes lost when DNR acquires land. And we specifically looked at non-hunting land. And that's PILT that's paid to counties and townships only, not school districts. And our conclusion was that PILT for newly acquired non-hunting land is on average across the state 64% higher than the county town taxes it replaces. Now that's not true everywhere because tax rates vary. So in some jurisdictions, in some counties, PILT could be less than the county town taxes. But on average throughout the state, it's about 64% higher. That's initially when you first acquire the land, but because state land isn't reappraised every year, it's reappraised every 5 years, that difference could be reduced over a five-year period if land values are increasing. If they're decreasing, that difference increases, and the PILT becomes even higher than it was before at the outset of the period than county town taxes. So it's a complicated area to look at. Our conclusion here was that counties are the main beneficiary of this difference between PILT and taxes. Townships get 2.5% of the PILT on average, but town taxes, if you look at their share across the state of combined county town taxes, their taxes are about 20%. So we're not replacing, on average, the town taxes lost, but we're the flip side of that is the counties are getting the benefit of that because they're getting 97.5% of the revenues on average, and their taxes are only about 80% of the combined taxes. And this results because when the laws were updated on PILT and tied to inflation, the township share was not tied to inflation. And so the township share has remained at a certain so many cents per acre or a certain share of it, and they have not gone up over time as land values have inflated. Some of the issues we posed in the report were obviously from what we found here, is PILT for acquired non-hunting land too high? Secondly, should townships get a greater share of PILT for acquired non-hunting lands? Thirdly, and this is a different issue, this is the acquired hunting lands, should school districts continue to receive PILT for acquired hunting lands? It could be argued, and we talk about this in the report, that for the most part, although not entirely, for the most part, school district revenues and school district tax rates are not affected by the acquisition of land by the state. There are exceptions. But for most PILT, we don't provide PILT to school districts. Acquired hunting lands is covered by an older law and perhaps a law that's outdated given our school financing system. And then finally, we pose the question of whether cities should be eligible for PILT. If the state land is in a city and not a township, and that occurs not frequently, but on occasion, if it's in a city, should not the city get what was the township share? Right now, it's going all entirely to the county. So those are some of the questions we posed about filth. Not a lot of definitive answers, but it's a difficult area to look at. Mr. Chairman, thank you for the opportunity to present the report, and we'd be glad to answer any questions that the committee has.
Well, thank you, Mr. Junker. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Junker, I wanted to go back to slide 22. And your second bullet point, the question on state land is reappraised once every 5 years. Is that a parcel, or is that a region, or so it's each parcel that's reappraised every 5 years?
Mr. Junker.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Hansen, you know, state land doesn't pay taxes. So unlike private land, there's really not a need to assess it every year, reassess it every year, its value. So what the law says is that every 5 years, state land is going to be reappraised. And that includes every piece of state land, every parcel. So in each county, every 5 years, the assessor is trying to reestablish what is the fair market value for that property. It's not used for the purposes of paying taxes, but it is used for the purpose, among other things, of establishing the PILT appraisal.
Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Junker, maybe I wasn't clear enough. So if you have a parcel and you have an adjoining parcel, are they all reappraised every 5 years, or do you have one parcel that's in 2011 and another parcel in 2012 and another parcel in 2013 and then a five-year period for those?
Mr. Junker.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, it is not staggered. I believe that it is, you know, all of it is done in 1 year. But it's done by each of the 87 counties, so each county has a responsibility for its particular area.
Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Junker, the rationale for answering that question is obviously right now in certain areas of the state with high commodity prices, you're going to see an appreciation of land values from maybe $3,000 or $4,000 an acre up to $6,000 or $7,000 an acre. And how does that market reality get adjusted on every five-year period? If you had certain parcels going at certain times, you'd roll that into the system for adjoining land sales. But if you have them all at one time, then you're going to miss the real price of land value. And so I think that's a question, and maybe you have an answer to that, but we are going to see a spike in land values this spring, and how does that come into reality in terms of either PILT or what we're paying for appraised values?
Comment, either Director Nobles or Mr. Junker?
Not really, Mr. Chairman. I mean, it gets into one of those complexities that I think is certainly worth considering, but I assume Representative Hansen is referring to the increase in commodity values that would be more applicable in the southern parts of the state, where the state does not own nearly as much land, so it may not have as much of an impact as it would up in the north, where the commodities are somewhat different, but it's still certainly something worth taking into consideration.
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Mr. Junker, could you explain a little bit more fully? You mentioned that the school levies were really not affected by PILT land. It would seem to me that as there's less private land in the tax base, you would in effect affect the school levy as well. Could you explain that?
Mr. Junker.
We got a few extra slides here that I brought along. I didn't want to get too deep into some of these things because I know you've got a lot on your agenda, but are school districts affected by state land purchases, the question, and for the most part, school district revenues are not affected. State, you know, the school financing system is set up in such a way that the revenues they get are adjusted depending on what their property values are. So to some extent, the revenues aren't affected, but they could be affected if it impacts property tax rates. And it could affect, let me put it this way, taxpayers could be affected in those school districts if it affects property tax rates, even though it may not affect their revenue levels of the school districts. So what tax rates could be affected? Well, tax rates for debt service levies might increase. But that's a very complicated area, and that's why I'm hedging a little bit, because it may not increase either. Tax rates for operating levies, and that's become an increasing share of school district revenues, tax rates for operating levies are affected by purchases of some property. So if the state bought ag homestead property, and that includes the house, the garage, and 1 acre of land, then that tax base would be taken away from the local school district, and the tax rate would have to increase on all the other properties in order to support a given amount of operating referendum levy. But if the state is purchasing ag non-homestead land, so all the other land on that property besides the 1 acre, or property that's not even homesteaded, or if they bought non-commercial seasonal recreational property, that land doesn't pay operating referendums. So that land, the tax rates would not be affected. It gets to be very complicated, and so I tried to summarize by saying, for the most part, but not entirely.
Thank you. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Yunker, early in your presentation, you talked about acquired land being about 25% of DNR's holdings. Does that include land that's donated or given to DNR after being acquired by someone else or given by a current landowner?
Mr. Yunker.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Torkelson, I think better if DNR answered that, but, you know, generally...
Mr. Yunker, DNR is nodding yes behind you. You can't see them.
So,
follow up, Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I believe it is, but I think DNR has to answer.
We'll get some more answers from DNR when they're up. I guess my question where I'm headed is, as that land is, you know, acquired by someone else, by someone, and its use is changed prior to its coming to into state hands, and its property tax classification may have also changed. I'm just kind of curious how that all works and if that is at all considered in your report today.
Mr. Yunker. Director Nobles. Phone a friend.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure I got the gist of that question.
Representative Torkelson, clarification.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For instance, if a piece of land had been productive farmland and had been changed into a wetland, for instance, restored wetland prior to coming into DNR's hands, the property tax value would have changed dramatically. And revenue from that land to the county would have changed dramatically as a result of reclassification. And I just, you know, this is all part of this picture, and I'm just curious if that was at all considered in your report.
Mr. Yunker.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Torkelson, not explicitly. It's kind of a real wrinkle on what could happen. Clearly, DNR is going to pay a higher value, even if that property was turned into a wetland. They might pay something closer to the farm value of the land to acquire it, but it depends on what they negotiate.
Mr.
Director Nobles.
Representative Torkelson, I mean, there are a variety of issues that could arise. One, I guess you may be looking at, is the issue of how it is classified for PILT purposes in our analysis, because I think we were showing that there are many different approaches to PILT depending on the use of the land, and in our analysis, whether the land was on the tax rolls or not, you're again kind of posing a variation on that. I think really the issue, though, and I know it has been a matter of some controversy, and it fits, I think, within the overall theme of our report, and that is the pressures on DNR to acquire, either on its own or through a third party, land that then it has to manage if that land ultimately comes to the state. And we looked at that to some degree. I know that there's been some concern and even some criticism that the relationships that DNR has developed with some third parties, nonprofits, may lend itself to some question about the acquisition and whether or not it was really within DNR's plan. Obviously, the state needs to act with a degree of independence in those kinds of situations, particularly, again, given the theme we have here, that it might be a great acquisition, but we need to understand what the ongoing management and maintenance costs are that we ultimately will have to pay for.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Wagenius.
Representative Torkelson brings up an issue that I think we have to deal with here, and I don't know how to deal with it, so it's just maybe for folks as they testify. But if somebody, using his example, converts 20 acres or 40 acres of farmland in a county to a wetland, what portion of that county tax base is that? Is it a 1%? Is it a 1/10%? Is it a 1/1000%? So knowing, without knowing the base that we're talking about, it's hard to see these impacts. And I think one of the things that we're going to have to talk about is, and that's been missing in these conversations, is not how many acres, but what portion of that county is actually leaving the tax rolls. And I don't know the answer to the question. I don't know how to get at it. But it seems that that's kind of critical.
Well, I think you make a good point, Representative Wagenius, and there, we do hope to get to some of the folks from county and townships, hopefully today, which thank you, Director, and Mr. Yonker for coming in, and appreciate you going first so we get this thing in order. Just to the members, to the folks in the audience and members, we're probably not going to get through. You have the list of testifiers today. We have some folks I knew that drove down through most of the night to be here from far northern Minnesota. I want to make sure they want to speak to Representative Drazkowski's bill. We will hear from the DNR and certainly questions for the DNR today. But I think Representative Drazkowski, Representative Cornish, we will be finishing your bills on Thursday. We're going to do Bowser tomorrow. We'll stay with that schedule. But what we don't get done today, and for the members of the audience, I know many of you on the list are generally here each day, so we'll respect the folks that aren't going to be here. And if there are any are folks that are in the audience that won't be able to be back Thursday, other than the folks that drove down from far northern Minnesota, if you could let one of the pages know, that would be good. Welcome. Any questions along those lines? Thank you. Welcome, Deputy Commissioner, back again from a little visit a few minutes ago.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, this analysis that we're presenting here addresses two of the questions that the Legislative Auditor Report raised, and that was questions related to resources available to manage existing state lands in the outdoor recreation system. And then the second question was the feasibility of existing long-range acquisition plans. Is it realistic to acquire the kinds of lands that some of these plans call for? Maybe just to touch on a couple of the questions that came up about the land base that's managed by DNR. About 73% of the lands are either trust fund lands that were transferred from the federal government back in the 1900s to support the K-12 education system, or consolidated conservation lands. These are lands in seven northern counties that the state purchased from counties in return for paying off ditch bonds, basically, that the counties had accrued, and the counties at that time were at risk of going bankrupt. And so a large share of this land base has been in state ownership for a long period of time. About 25% of the land base, or 1.5 million acres, is what we call acquired acres. And to Representative Torkelson's question, I think it was, that includes not only lands that DNR has purchased, but also lands that have been donated to the agency for conservation purposes, and also lands that the counties have actually either granted to DNR, tax forfeit lands that the counties either granted to DNR or sold to DNR So they were actually existing public lands that just moved from county management to state management. The real gist of this report, and I think you've got the report, and there's a lot of detail on this slide, but if you turn to page 7 in the report, this table includes a lot of information, and I thought what might be most helpful is to actually walk you through this table kind of from left to right so you understand what these numbers mean. First of all, in the far left column, we've got the various types of land that were included in this report. In the next column, it's an assessment of the funding, total funding that's available both for management of those lands and for acquisition of those lands. And so you can see under that second column, there's a total number. For example, for aquatic management areas, there's a total of $2.9 million available for both management and acquisition, and then you can see the breakout between those two. Now, this total funding available was a little bit complicated to come up with. It includes what we consider base funding, and what we did was we took the 2010-11 biennium and took an average annual dollar amount that was available for both acquisition and management from our base funding sources, and then it also includes some assessment of special funding, and by special funding we mean one-time funding. So this would include bonding dollars that we might have obtained from the legislature either for management or acquisition, the new legacy funds, funding from the Environmental Trust Fund, and so forth. And the fact that legacy funds are included here, I'll back up one step. What we did, because those one-time funds are very volatile. They change from year to year, whether or not it's a bonding year, for example. We took a five-year average of those one-time funds and reflected that in this total annual funding that's available. And because legacy funds, the outdoor heritage funds primarily, are considered special funding, the first 2 years of legacy funding is actually included here as being available funding to both manage land and acquire land. So that's the total funding available. If you move to the next two columns there, titled Land Management Needs at the top, that is an assessment of what we believe, and I'll get into the details of how we generated these numbers, but an assessment of what we believe might be needed to manage those lands, and then the gap, the annual funding gap, the difference between what we've got available to manage those lands and what some of the models might indicate the need is. And so if you look at the wildlife management area line down towards the bottom there, you can see that the amount available for management is about $14 million. The total annual amount necessary to manage the existing system is almost $20 million, and the difference there is the gap, and that's $5.9 million. And again, I'll get into the details of how we estimated those needs in a little bit, because it's very important to understand that as you start to discuss what this might mean. The next two columns, titled Scenario A, include what those additional land management costs might be over the next 10 years if we continue to acquire land at current rates of acquisition. And so you can see there, again looking at the wildlife management area line, that the annual amount necessary to manage that expanded land base, not only the current lands but the additional lands that we would acquire over the next 10 years at current rates of purchase, would be about $42 million, and that funding gap increases from $5.9 million to about $15.4 million. And then the far right two columns, titled Scenario B, would be that same sort of analysis if we actually acquired lands at rates called for in some of the existing acquisition plans that were following or that we've adopted. For example, the Citizen Advisory Committee plan for wildlife management areas or aquatic management area programs would call for accelerated rates of acquisition above and beyond the rates at which we're buying land right now. And obviously, the funding gap grows quite a bit based on that accelerated acquisition of lands. Maybe before I move on from this table, Mr. Chairman, there's a lot of data here and it's a little bit complicated, so if there are questions of clarification on this table before I kind of get into how we generated these numbers, maybe it'd be a good time to stop.
Any questions here, members? Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. On scenario A and B, how many years out are you looking at these projections?
Deputy Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, it's a 10-year analysis, but the dollars reflected there are annual needs. And so what we did is we looked out, if we continued to buy land at our current rate under scenario A, after 10 years, we would have some additional level of state land, and then we did the analysis and said the annual cost would be what's reflected here going forward.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Deputy Commissioner. It seems like, as we look at this, it seems like the allocation towards management obviously is not what's needed in order to manage things properly, but at the same time, the acquisition dollars seem to be inflated beyond what we can afford. I wouldn't expect your agency would be planning in this unsustainable way. What pressures are bringing this condition?
Deputy Commissioner Shad.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Drazkowski, I'm going to touch on that issue a little later in the presentation, so can we come back to that?
Yes, we can.
Thank you.
Is that fine, Representative Drazkowski? Didn't mean to speak for you, sorry. Representative Quam.
Mr. Chair, and maybe the people here aren't the ones that answer this. I'd like to know, looking at this, I would estimate that in your scenarios that you're getting up to where you're having a quarter of the land in the state, you know, if we're at about 17% now, I'd like to find out just how much land, because if a quarter is taken out of the tax rolls, it's not just the cost of maintaining, it's a huge burden on the local, you know, government entity. So I think this committee really ought to have an idea of how much in acreage and land is going to be taken out if we go through these scenarios.
Deputy Commissioner, and I think Representative Quam, it's along the lines of Representative Wagenius, and hopefully some of our local units of government, when they come forward, maybe it'll be on Thursday. They're able to address just what has been the change, what will be the change with the different scenarios going forward. I think it also leads to a discussion and what I would say is a limited Attorney General's opinion about use of some of the dedicated money from Lessard SAMS and potentially also LCCMR, that the reality of if we're going to be buying additional lands in those programs, isn't it prudent that we make arrangements for the maintenance and ongoing expenses like payment in lieu of taxes or whatever they are? I think people that voted for that amendment didn't expect somebody else to pay part of their bills for their time enjoying the outdoors. So I think, Representative Quam, you raise a great question, and one that kind of probably a big part of this whole discussion. So thank you. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Deputy Commissioner Shad, I wanted to go to the management question, and maybe you address this. But looking at these amounts, it doesn't really address who does the management. And I think we've had some testimony earlier in committee about privatization and with the budget, and we won't see the budget here for another 20 minutes, but what happens with DNR employees that are doing these jobs now and outsourcing the management tasks to nonprofit groups to do this work on public lands? I mean, what's the intent here, and how is that going to work?
Deputy Commissioner Shad.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, you know, with the advent of legacy funding and and at the same time, pressures on the general fund. It's kind of a brave new world out there as far as how we get our work done, and we are seeing this shift from the agency DNR doing a lot of this work, whether it's buying land or managing some of these existing lands. We're seeing that shift a lot to some of our partners, and we can debate whether that's a good thing or not, but the fact is that's kind of the new reality for us. I should mention, and Commissioner Bob Meyer just reminded me of this, these numbers reflect dollars that are appropriated to DNR. There are legacy funds, and I think this is what you're getting at, Representative Hansen. There are legacy funds, outdoor heritage funds, that are being directed to some of the nonprofit organizations, Pheasants Forever, for example, that aren't reflected here, and they are using those dollars to help bridge this gap. So, for example, the wildlife management area gap, the $5.9 million, we haven't done that calculation, and that number kind of bounces around every year, so it's very hard to pin that down, but it's probably closer to $2 or $3 million if you consider legacy funds that are going to these other organizations, and they're doing management on our lands, and that's an important point here. The gap isn't as large as it might appear here because there are other dollars at state funding, but there are other dollars being applied to management of those lands.
Follow-up, Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair and Director Shad, so if we have DNR employees that are being paid with general fund or game and fish fund dollars to take care of land, and they're laid off or that funding is cut, and then those tasks are outsourced or privatized to nonprofits, isn't that supplanting?
Deputy Commissioner Shad.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, a lot of the work that's being outsourced either to private organizations or to contractors is actually new or accelerated work that we're being asked to do as a result of the new legacy funding. So while we are seeing kind of less capacity in the agency to do this sort of work as a result both of general fund pressures but also just a general tightening down of game and fish appropriations over the last 4 to 6 years and that sort of thing, the lion's share of the additional work that's going to others here is new and accelerated work from the new funding source.
No, thank you. Continue on with your presentation.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a reminder that this report does not include parks and trails. There was a similar analysis done back in 2009 that took the same kind of look at our existing park and trail system. And that annual funding gap for park and trails was identified at about $6 million annually. Now, to get into a little bit more detail on how these numbers were generated, the management needs were generated, I thought I'd take a look at the two largest land bases that are reflected in that table on page 7, and that's our state forest land base and our wildlife management area land base. For state forest lands, what we did is we took a look at all the activities that are needed to basically manage forest lands, everything from forest inventory, the 10 and 50-year planning efforts that take place out there, applying silviculture out in the land, building roads, keeping our land certified by third-party certifiers, developing the databases and the GIS and that sort of thing to support our land management. So it's basically an analysis of what it takes to manage our forest lands. And so it's as much about managing that state land as it is about managing our forest programs in the state. And so the number there, the $7.2 million gap, isn't so much directly related to what it takes to manage land as it is what it takes to manage our forest programs here in the state that are largely directed at state land, state forest lands. The analysis for wildlife management areas took a little different approach here. We actually focused on activities, management activities that we apply to the land. So, for example, for prescribed fire, we we develop a model where for prairie lands we would ideally burn those lands every 3 to 5 years. For brush lands, we would burn those lands every 10 years. For some forest types, we would burn them every 20 to 40 years. So you can just develop a fairly straightforward model looking at the number of acres of those habitats, apply those rotations for prescribed fire to those lands. We've got good information on what it takes to burn an acre of land, and then you can develop an analysis of those total annual costs. And so you just go on down down the list there. It was a series of models that added up to the total cost here. Some conclusions, and I think I'll get at some of the questions that were raised earlier. First off, this funding gap that's been identified does not mean that our state lands aren't being actively managed. I think one of the surprises in this report actually was that there was as many dollars for wildlife management areas, for example, upwards of $14 million, that there were as many dollars going towards management of lands as there were. These models that I just discussed, for example, the prescribed burning model, is just that. It's a model based on an ideal. And if we don't burn a grassland every 3 to 5 years, and instead that rotation is 4 to 6 years or 5 to 7 years, certainly it's not ideal, but there's still tremendous conservation value in those lands, and our lands are being managed at a fairly high standard. We could certainly do better based on these models, but the fact is that these lands are being managed at a fairly high level. Also, not all these lands require the same frequency of management activities. For example, early on when we buy a piece of wildlife management area land and we have to do some restoration work, for example, restore a wetland or a grassland, for the first 5 or 10 years the costs are very high. Once those practices are in place and those habitats are established, those long-term costs go down very significantly. And then I also mentioned earlier that we do have partner organizations that are helping us bridge that gap that was reflected on page 7. But I think this idea or this statement that seems to be out there that we can't manage the lands that we already own isn't totally accurate. I think there's a lot behind this information that we need to evaluate, and I think these models, these estimates of what an ideal management condition might be, are very helpful to us and hopefully helpful to you as you kind of make decisions and weigh the relative need of investing more in management of existing lands versus acquiring new lands, but we are making significant investments in our lands. Also, we have a very diverse funding portfolio here to help us manage these lands, and certainly the legacy funds have been a big help, and kind of the need to better manage our lands was one of the driving reasons, one of the really important reasons why people felt we needed to dedicate additional dollars for habitat in this state. It was in part to acquire more lands, but it was also in large part to do a better job of managing the lands that we've got. And I think that we have seen significant investment after the first couple of years of legacy funding on those management needs, and we've been able to bridge that gap. If we had done this analysis a couple of years ago, that gap would be much bigger. But we've been able to shrink that gap, and I think as we move forward, hopefully the information in this report will help us make decisions about opportunities to further bridge that gap. I might also point out that Minnesota Management and Budget was asked to develop a report that followed this report to look at existing funding that's available to do this kind of work, and then to also evaluate some options for how we might approach addressing some of these funding needs. And that report was delivered, I believe, in mid-January, And you might want to take a look at recommendations in that report and some of the findings in that report to take a look at how we might approach funding some of these management needs. And then finally, we certainly recognize that we need to manage our public lands out there at a very high level. There's tremendous benefit from these public lands, both in terms of recreation, in terms of conservation, and in terms of the economy out there. 26% of our timber comes off of state forest lands. We've got huge recreational economies that are supported by these public lands, and we need to manage them at a very high level to support those very important quality of life and economic considerations for Minnesotans. We were asked to take a look at the feasibility of some of these long-range plans that we've developed for acquiring new lands. And the report does address that, and in most cases, the report found that we certainly have the capacity between DNR and our many partners to acquire land at the rate that is called for in some of these reports. And that we certainly have interest from landowners. We've got long lists of willing landowners, for example, that have land in high priority areas for conservation, for recreation, and that would be willing to sell their land to DNR or to other organizations for conservation reasons. And so from both a capacity and an interest standpoint from landowners, those lands are certainly realistic, or those plans are certainly realistic. And those plans, in many cases, are citizen-based plans. The DNR doesn't buy land because, as an agency, we want more public land. We're buying land because the citizens want us to buy more land, whether it's for recreation or other purposes. And we're getting much better at targeting our acquisition lands. Commissioner Landwehr has used the term precision conservation. We've got GIS models. We've got tools available now where we can really be strategic in the lands that we're purchasing, making sure that when we buy that piece of land, it's going to provide maximum benefits, not only for habitat, but also for flood damage retention, for water quality benefits, and so forth. And so we're not scattergunning these new acquisitions out in the landscape. They're very, very focused, very, very strategic in where we're buying those lands. Finally, and to close here, as you get into this land acquisition debate, I just wanted to highlight one effort, and the legislative auditor pointed it out, and it's something that we call land asset management. And we have piloted this in one county up in Russell County. We've actually sat down with the county, looked at the mix of public lands in that county. They include consolidated conservation lands, trust fund lands, lands that we've acquired for either state forests or wildlife management areas, and county managed lands, tax forfeit lands. And we sat down in the county, taken a look at this very complicated land base, and come up with what we call a land asset plan. And that plan includes opportunities to exchange land between the county and the state to consolidate holdings. It identifies priorities for selling state land or selling county land and reinvesting those resources in perhaps other public lands in higher priority areas. And it does identify some agreement between DNR and the county on where we might make those additional investments if we're going to acquire new lands. And Commissioner Landwehr has an interest in taking this idea of land asset plans or land asset efforts to other counties and really sitting down and talking about this public land base, making it work better for us, making it work better for counties, and making it work better for our state citizens. So with that, I'll take some questions.
Mr. Thank you, Deputy Commissioner Shad. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Shad, thank you for being here. Mm-hmm. I wasn't going to ask about the Roseau County land exchange thing, but I do know that it's a very complicated matter. I think the discussions have gone on for over 2 years now, and if my information is correct, the state is actually going to wind up with more acres in this exchange than what the county is, and we need to do some things to help streamline this process so we can speed it up, because it's become very frustrating for our county commissioners, I know that. But anyway, with regards to your management plans, I'm wondering how are they written? And how specific are the plans? And when I say specific, again, I'll go back to where I live. There are vast tracts of state land, but then there are also small 40-acre parcels, 80-acre parcels that are scattered in that checkerboard that we talk about. Are the management plans written, and are they specific to small parcels, or is it a general plan? Thank you.
Deputy Commissioner Shad.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Fabian, first on the land exchange comment that you made, we agree that doing land exchanges is complex. There's a lot of steps. Some are actually embedded in the Constitution that we need to go through, but they do end up taking a long amount of time. Commissioner Landwehr has actually talked about maybe trying to speed that up by actually doing land exchanges by statute, actually getting some agreement on value and specific parcels, and actually having the legislature do some of these exchanges rather than kind of going through our normal process. So we're very interested in looking at all kinds of opportunities here to speed up that process, because we think exchanges are really, really an important tool here in helping us manage our public land base. As far as whether there are written management plans, it depends on the kind of lands you're looking at. For scientific and natural areas, for example, where it's a very small land base, there are very detailed plans that are developed to ensure that the specific rare resources or rare plant communities that are that land was purchased to protect are adequately managed. For state forest lands, they tend to be more landscape level plans, so you don't go down to the specific, 40 acres of forest, but there's a landscape level goal that land management is intended to achieve. For wildlife management areas, it's kind of a mix. For some of those wildlife management areas, we do have detailed management plans. For others, we don't, but we're in the process of developing those. In fact, LCCMR has recommended a project that would provide funding for us to develop a comprehensive database and a system so that we could actually, for every one of our wildlife management areas and aquatic management areas, we would have detailed management plans developed that would enable us to actually look, rather than relying on these models of prescribed burning every 3 to 5 years, we would actually look parcel by parcel at what our field managers believe those management needs are, and we could project out those needs and the costs associated with those needs into the future. And that's very, very important to, I think, help us all kind of address this question of what kind of funding is needed going forward here to manage our lands.
Thank you, Deputy Commissioner. I've got about 4 more questions that would like to be asked, and we're going to get additional opportunities on Thursday. We will ask somebody from the DNR to be available on Thursday for additional questions. But Representative Drazkowski, I do want to get your bill just before us to begin the informational discussion and allow the folks from the far northern part of the state and Mr. Peterson to speak today. So, Representative Drazkowski, you had a question. No, we'll do that. We have 4 questions, Representative Drazkowski, 4 members with questions. We'll do those, and then I'll bring you up if that works. Representative Drazkowski, you had a question.
Mr. Chair, thank you. In the interest of the folks that came here to speak, I'll wait until the next hearing to ask those questions.
And we do have time for these questions, so we're okay. So you okay still waiting, Representative Drazkowski? We're not that pressed. I'm just trying to lay it out here.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will ask a question. Mr. Shad, I don't know that I really received the full answer to what are the external or internal pressures that are bringing us to acquire more land than we have money to manage. And I kind of hearing this circular response to page 7 in your report. On one hand, it seems to demonstrate that the department needs more finances in order to manage land, and the other it suggests that we're doing okay and we really are managing the land to the level that it needs to be. At least that's what I heard. I'm captured by the what would be the 1, 2, 3, 4th column over on page 7, annual funding gap, it says between the amount available for management and annual amount necessary to manage the existing system. And that's pretty compelling to me. I'd be interested in your comments on that. And then I wonder about whether we should say the word properly or adequately manage in terms of those scenarios.
Deputy Commissioner Schatt.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman and Representative Truskolski, it's not a trivial issue here, and that's why I spent a little bit of time talking about how these numbers were generated. There, we didn't and we don't have the capability right now to go out and look at every parcel of land and say here's what that parcel of land needs over the next 10 or 15 years, and here's when each of those management actions would take place, and here's what it would cost. And this is a very coarse kind of analysis based on some models. Again, looking at the number of acres of grass we've got out there, a 3-5 rotation for burning, and what would that cost be? I think we'll have a better answer to that question of is this gap real or not once we get this system developed where we can actually look parcel by parcel. But I think the other really important question that we all need to grapple with is just how finely and how intensively do we want to manage our lands? We could put a lot more money than even is reflected here in what's necessary to manage the existing system to try to squeeze out more and more conservation benefits from those lands. For example, on our native or on some of our grasslands, we could introduce more and more species. We could manage them more and more intensively. But as we invest more dollars, the return on that investment is going to be smaller and smaller. It really is diminishing returns there. And so I think we need to make some decisions about the standard to which we manage those lands. It's going to be very different for a scientific and natural area where we're trying to kind of manage for some pristine kind of rare resource there that is kind of irreplaceable. And that standard is going to be different for a wildlife management area where the purpose there is habitat and recreation. And if we slip on that standard a little bit, we're still going to have tremendous value for those public lands. And so I think that the question before all of us is the how much more do we want to invest in these lands to raise them to a higher conservation value versus taking advantage of opportunities to invest in additional public lands, and finding that balance, finding that tipping point will be important. The models that we developed here are kind of an optimum, I guess. If we didn't manage at this level, those lands would still have tremendous value for recreation, for habitat, for abating or improving water quality, whatever values those lands might provide. So we could do less than what's called for in this report and still have tremendous benefits from public lands. We could invest even more than what's called for in this report and see some incremental gain in conservation value, and I think that's the question before
us. Thank you, Deputy Commissioner. You're good. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. Mr. Schatt, realizing the number could vary a great deal, could you give us just a ballpark figure of the cost of conducting a control burn on a per acre basis?
Deputy Commissioner Schatt, he asked for a short answer.
Boy. Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, I don't have that number off the tip of my here, I think.
Deputy Commissioner, if you could get us that back before Representative Anderson's bill comes to this committee on Thursday, that would be beneficial. I think it talks to some of what he's talking about. And I think it, along the lines you've made comments about, there's different ways to manage these public lands for sure, and different costs associated, and The dedicated funding that passed overwhelmingly in 2008, if I'm not mistaken, part of the bill coming before this committee a little later this session includes $6 million, if I remember right, for maintenance and investment in existing wildlife management areas. And we know that'll go a long ways to some of the things that we talked about, and I think most of us here would agree that's what a lot of us voted for, was to see improvements. And I agree with you, Deputy Commissioner, that there's certainly value in the wildlife management areas today, even if they are brome grass and too many cottonwoods. And with $6 million, we're going to be able to get a lot of them in a direction that will probably produce more mallards, more pheasants, and more songbirds for everybody to enjoy. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner Shad, last fall there was, I think the agency indicated they were developing a new process for WMA acquisition. I see Mr. Simons in the audience, and maybe at a later meeting we could have that. But one of the components of that was to give, I think, one point or a small point of the whole for acquisition proximity of 50 miles to a population center. And, Mr. Chair, some of the interest groups opposed that one point or a small point because they felt that that would be putting WMAs near metropolitan areas. And I think areas like the chair and I represent, we have a lot of folks who need access close by. May have people who want to learn how to hunt or fish that they can't hop in an Escalade and drive up to Representative Fabian's area, or Representative Hancock's area, or Representative Dill's area. They many of them have limited time because they're single parent, maybe working two or three jobs, but they want to learn how to hunt and fish. And so I'd like to know what happened to that small itty-bitty preference to give some access and recognize that some of these areas should be built where some of the folks are.
Deputy Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, the tool you're talking about actually looked at a whole bunch of factors that we would consider when we're selecting that parcel of land to acquire, and it is an effort, as I said earlier, to try to be more strategic, and I think that proximity to where people live is an important consideration, because one of the reasons we buy public land, especially in southern and western areas, is for recreational purposes. And looking at Wildlife Chief Dennis Simon, I believe that is still a criteria in that model. It is. So.
Well, thank you, Representative Hansen. And so, Deputy Commissioner Shad, that something that's important to both Representative Hansen and I, the Vermilion Highlands Wildlife Management Area out in Castle Rock Township, we hope continues to be a big priority for the state, because it's an unbelievable opportunity. 3 miles across, folks, at its widest point. We don't want it full of blacktop trails and motorized vehicles. We want kids from the inner city to be able to go down and touch the real outdoors, 18 minutes from when you get on the freeway right here outside the Capitol, and you can be to this beautiful area that we worked a deal out with the University of Minnesota. Representative Dill, last question, and then we'll bring down the Representative Draskowski will come and tell us what his bill is about, and we'll hear from the people out of town and those that can't come back. Representative Dill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. On the pilot project up in Roseau County, could you give me the size and scope of that relative to some of the other counties that would be challenging, like Coochiching or St. Louis or Itasca, in terms of trying to, it seems to me that starting out small is good, but how big is big compared to what you're doing over there, and what kind of difficulties briefly? I want the committee to understand the difference between a county like that and other counties that are going to be more challenging.
Deputy Commissioner Shad, do you have that information?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dill, it's certainly not one of the counties with a very large percentage of public land. I'm guessing Regional Director Carroll is in the audience in the 20 to 30% range for public.
26%.
26%,
and we picked that because that's the mid range of our counties. 8%.
Assistant Commissioner Carroll, why don't you come down and just identify yourself, and you can make that statement. That'd be okay, but go ahead, come down, Assistant Commissioner. Deputy Commissioner, you got any comment?
Yeah.
Well, we utilize the 5 seconds he's on his way down.
Right. It's not at the high end as far as percentage of public land, but it's not at the very low end. If you look at counties in the southwest, it's maybe 1 to 2% public land. In some of the northeast counties, it's 80 to 90% public land. This is somewhere in between, around 25-26%.
Welcome to the committee, and welcome for your new appointment, Assistant Commissioner. I know that changes your retirement plan. I had a discussion with you when we were on the snowmobiles on Saturday. You were there Saturday in the middle of your day, and you were down last night, I know, at 9:30 in the town of Pine Island in Representative Draskowski and Representative Quam's district, chairing the meeting with somewhere in the neighborhood of 350 to 400 people that are interested in CWD. Welcome, and could you elaborate on Representative Dill's comment of the percentage of land?
I could, and thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. We picked Roosevelt.
And who are you again?
My name is Mike Carroll, currently Northwest Regional Director. Excuse me. I was Northwest Regional Director, now I'm an Assistant Commissioner for Outreach and Operations. I'll still be stationed up in Park Rapids. Representative Dill, in the northwestern part of the state, we have a mix of agricultural and then heavily forested counties, and we have a mix of low ownership, around 2 to 8%, some of our agricultural counties, to upwards of Lake of Woods County, where we're almost 50% state ownership and those types of things. We are currently dealing, as to regards to your question, we are very much aware, because we attend the Northern County Land Use Board coordinating committees. Regional Director Engwall and myself attend those, and we will address, as we go over the next couple of years, we will address counties where there actually is, if you count federal and other ownership, there is upwards of 80% public ownership in the counties that are up in your part of the state. So we will deal with that. We picked Roseau County because we had a willing county board. The county board identified unorganized townships where they spoke for the township so that we could do some exchanges and some preliminary work. And now even in Roseau County, we started very small. We are now moving to the eastern part of the county where there are organized townships. There is more ownership, consolidated state ownership, and it won't be just exchanges. It will be directed sales and some of those other things. So we are very much aware of the point that in some counties it's a whole different scale because the ownership is way over 60%, and we are preparing to address those issues with those counties. Does that answer your question?
Any follow-up, Representative Dill?
No.
Okay, thank you. Representative Draskowski, why don't you, thank you, Deputy Commissioner, Assistant Commissioner. Representative Draskowski, why don't you come explain your bill a little bit? I know specifically Mr. Peterson from the Farmers Union, and I believe Dell Erickson, are you in the audience as a citizen? Yeah, we're going to hear both of those before, and then we're going to spend the rest of the time with the county commissioners from far northern Minnesota. So, Representative Draskowski, if you want to give it a minute or two on what your bill would do, and then we'll hear from a couple of those folks, and then spend the rest of the time with the folks from far northern Minnesota. Representative Draskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members, this bill is pretty self-explanatory. We have had discussions on the House floor in the past about this problem that we have of government purchase of land seemingly being on autopilot without any governor on the engine, if you will. And that is what this bill would do. It would provide that if we, as a state government, buy additional land, that we declare a certain amount of, or we declare an equal amount of that surplus and sell that land and provide for a no net gain of land within Minnesota. Mr. Chair, I don't really want to say a lot more about that. I'd like to reserve the time for the others.
Thank you, Representative Draskowski. Representative Cornish, will you come down and explain your bill just a little bit about what it does? It's another bill that we're going to have more discussion about on Thursday, but just so that we know, you also have a similar a bill that deals with similar land in a different fashion. If you could just explain what it is, and then we'll hear from the folks out of town. Representative Cornish, welcome to the committee, and thanks for sitting in today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll make mine real quick because these folks have come a long ways, and mine can come back easily on Thursday. But my bill would be a little bit opposite that. It'd be a no net loss of hunting land, restricted to hunting land. It calls for a lot of studies, inventory, and get a control on what's out there as far as hunting land, And if any hunting land was reduced, there would be a plan to replace it with equitable or equal hunting land in the future. So I think it's not too much of a fiscal cost, because a lot of this GIS and mapping, everything in inventory is already done. And so that's a basic explanation.
Thanks, Representative Cornish. First, we'll hear from Mr. Erickson. If you could just give us a minute of your presentation, and if you have a handout, if the pages would pass it out, and if you would not read the entire statement, that would be great. If you just want to take a minute to give us your thoughts on this issue. Mr. Erickson.
Chairman McNamara, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to speak with you. I'll be very brief.
Mr. Erickson, can you identify yourself for the record?
My name is Del Erickson. I'm from Brooklyn Center. Thank you. The bill is an attempt to freeze ecological services at today's levels. In my opinion, it is a very low and troublesome barter. One of its primary objectives in regards to the law around the LCCMR and the Heritage Fund is to prevent land purchases. Attempting to stop them from purchasing land to preserve, protect, and enhance Minnesota's natural environment. The implication is that no land purchase can be made without sacrificing another piece of another area.
Mr. Erickson, could you hit a couple of the high points in it? We do have the handout. Thank you.
I just have a few more
sentences. Go ahead.
For water, it means no net gain in wetlands, despite what Bowser may do. For pollution, it implies increases in pollution that is not resolved by natural processes and increases in cost to consumers, no matter what the PCA does. Finally, we are discussing limits to growth. Most researchers have concluded we have reached or exceeded our growth limits. Preventing land acquisitions as a means of encouraging population growth is a circular and self-destructive process. I hope this bill goes no further. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Erickson. Questions? Mr. Peterson, if you want to come forward and present your ideas on behalf of the Farmers Union.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee. My name is Doug Peterson. I'm president of the Minnesota Farmers Union. Our members have expressed and are growing frustrated with the amount of state land owned for many reasons. Number one, the maintenance and upkeep is probably the number one issue, whether it is the upkeep on the drainage systems or controlling thistles or weeds on the property. Competition for land is also key, whether it's for crop, grazing, or haying. Our members have become frustrated with the competition that is out there on land purchases. Loss of revenue to local communities, as you heard the legislative auditor talk about that, that seems like a very complicated issue. But there are loss of revenues from taking land permanently out of production, and that is another key. Productive farmland taking out of production. Minnesota Farmers Union urges the Department of Natural Resources and other agencies to continue to explore the working lands concept that works with farmers to acquire easements and reward farmers for adding conservation or wildlife benefits to the farm, and not always to have to be about buying land and taking it out of production. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, committee.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Questions? Thank you. Now we'll hear from two commissioners from Lake County and Coochin County, Mr. Siv, I apologize if I messed that up, and Mr. Pavlik. If one of you want to identify yourself and go first, that would be great. Welcome. Thank you. We have about 10 minutes left in the committee time, and it's my intention to use the rest of the time for your presentation and questions. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Thank you for the opportunity to sit here and speak today. My name is Rich Svay. I'm a Lake County Commissioner from the northeastern part of the state. We are a forested county, as many of you know. I'm sure many of you have visited our fair county, and would invite you if you haven't. We are approximately 1.3 million acres of land. 84% of that is publicly owned. It is the opinion of the Lake County Board of Commissioners that we are at the maximum percentage of public lands. Our board is split on whether the amount should be reduced from what that currently is of 84%. We also believe in land consolidation and have worked with the state, federal, and public entities to reduce the hodgepodge of land ownership. Lake County also sells county fee land to benefit these consolidation efforts. I believe these type of plans should also be the focus of the state. We also wish to be at the table when acquisition of lands occur within our borders. That is a policy I would like to see adopted related to other land purchases. Many times there is good reason for the state to acquire specific properties. The county can aid the state in this. And if at later time, if you'd like, I have examples that we could discuss. But there are also times when local government does not believe it is in the public's best interest. I'd also like to see the state maintain an inventory of their lands and the management plan for these same lands. As to House File 332, the Lake County Board would support the language as proposed, but clarifying that it fits for Lake County that has such a large public ownership. I'll stop here, welcome your questions. Happy to provide any examples, further information. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. C. Mr. Pavlik, let's hear from you first, then we'll have questions for both of you.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Wade Pavlik. I'm a commissioner and chairman of the county board, Coochin County, International Falls, way up north. You know, I just want to start this out. I didn't have much time to prepare. I don't have an overhead, but my administrator had a good point. You know, picture's worth a thousand words. This is a picture of Coochin County. We're the second largest county in land area in Minnesota. Got a population of probably 13,500 people to support this entire mass of land. I want to point out, I don't know if any of you can see this, but you see most of the color is green, red, and yellow. The white is privately held land, and I challenge you to find it in there. There is that little private land for us to work with, use as a tax base to support this infrastructure. We have the largest repository. Okay, yeah, great. We've got the largest repository of wetlands in the continental United States, county repository. Alaska's got some that are bigger. We must have, you know, I don't have those figures with me right now, probably a quarter of the state's wetlands concentrated in that county. For all intents and purposes, 83% of the county is classified as a wetland. We're a wetland repository. It makes any type of development nearly impossible. I mean, I've been doing this for 20 years. And it's frustrating. My question is, when you look at a map like that, why in the world would the state need more land? We're managing what we have to the best of our ability. We operate much more efficiently than the state. I've got all kinds of figures to prove that. You know, we have this private study from the DNR. The counties, to my knowledge, have not been involved. I'm the chairman of the Northern Counties Association that was mentioned earlier by Mike. I'm vice chairman of the AMC Environment Natural Resources Committee. I've been a member since 1992. And the one thing that's been missing, in my opinion, all these years is full engagement of the counties as a partner when it comes to land issues. It's the most important thing we deal with, especially in a county like mine, where we have such little private land, to provide the tax base, to provide the services. So I come here not with a sense of frustration, but to try to educate the committee and the legislature on what we see as being needed. Looking at this from AMC's point of view, I think, you know, we have not taken a formal position, but speaking from that committee, you know, I support this bill. But if you look at it from a statewide perspective, we need a comprehensive plan that the counties are involved in putting together. And I agree with previous testimony that the DNR and other state agencies should have to come to the table with county boards and get their approval. And I can tell you, you know, when I first started, we found the state agencies not always good partners, but that's improved a lot, especially with the DNR, Bowser. I mean, we've got some good people there now, and relations are better, and they have been keeping us informed. But there is nothing formally in the process or enacted that requires counties to be involved in approval. And I think that's another thing that's missing, going back to a comprehensive plan. So I'll end it there and certainly stand for any questions. And thank you for the opportunity to speak, Mr. Chairman.
Well, thank you both, Commissioner and Commissioner, that we really appreciate you coming down and speaking up. I think you add a good perspective to what we need to do. I think we need to build on the model of Roseau County, where we're working with the county and looking at what ways can we work together. The land exchange and land opportunities to move land, private ownership and exchange land, are way too cumbersome today. They're, and if Commissioner Landwehr is suggesting that maybe we need to do it by statute, that really shows that we're in a tough spot. If we think the legislature can do that better, a commissioner does, I think we're in need of fixing some things. There's opportunities where there is land up north that probably shouldn't be in public ownership anymore. And there's spots where we want to have more public land, but I think we need to realize this is a tough balance, and you folks in God's country up there have a completely different perspective than someone like me that lives in the seven-county metro area, and our thoughts of public land are the WMAs and WPAs we go to around the state to hunt on, and so it's an important perspective. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Pavlik, I'm from Roseau, and I just want the committee to hear the frustration in your voice and pay attention to that, because that's what we deal with almost constantly, and I'm not exaggerating when I say that. These situations with regards to publicly held lands are extremely, extremely frustrating to local government units, and we have to tackle this problem. So I'm just reemphasizing what you say, and I know what your frustration is, so thank you for being here.
Representative Fabian, for those in the audience, your testimony is very eerie from the exact same seat that former Representative Maxine Pepin sat in when I first passed, who passed away, former member Representative Maxine Pennis, literally sat in that seat when Representative Dill and I were sitting over in the area where Representative Falk is, and she said the exact same thing in 2003 and 2004. But she did it, Representative Fabian, with a little more emotion in her voice and a little bit more of pounding on the table. So if you're going to carry on her legacy, it's interesting that a health phy-ed teacher does it different than can somebody help me out? What kind of a teacher was she must have been like an English teacher or something. I see everybody shaking their head. She was a teacher for a number of years, and I'm sure her daughter Mary will send me an email what kind of teacher. But your point, you're doing a good job of representing your district, Representative Fabian, and she's watching you and enjoying what you have to say. Representative Ant, I'm sorry, did yours was a comment, not a looking for a question? Yeah, good job. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. To either county commissioner, I was under the impression that county boards did have to approve land sales to the government DNR or Fish and Wildlife. Are you telling us that you do not have a formal approval process in your counties?
Chairman Pavlik or Commissioner Say?
I can only speak for Coochin County. I can give you a perfect example. This occurred 10 or 12 years ago. We have so little private land and a farm, one of the most beautiful farms in Coochin County on the Little Fork River. Some of the only high land there is, agricultural, nice buildings, came up tax forfeit. All of a sudden, the assessor came in and said, gee, the DNR grabbed that. Well, no contact with us whatsoever. And, of course, we had some fairly hot meetings over that. They felt they needed it for a bird sanctuary, for waterfall wildlife. Didn't work with us, and on top of that, it took that valuable piece of tax base off the tax rolls. It isn't about one individual piece of property. It's a cumulative effects of taking that land. I can only speak for myself. I can speak for my county board on this. I don't want to speak for the other agencies because we haven't formalized position on this. But, we're willing to work with the DNR. Sometimes land exchanges make sense. Consolidating holdings, gee, that's just good business practices. So we're willing to do that. But to answer your question, that's an example of where that land was taken. We had no input on that. To their credit, we did raise a lot of holy water, and to this day, over the past decade, they've sat down with us before they make any moves. But that is more an issue of a good, effective management.
Thank you, Chairman. Last question, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I need some clarification. You've used the word taken several times. Was that land eminent domain, or was there a willing seller?
That land was taxed forfeit, and before the county could finish its process.
Chairman Pavlik. Okay, thank you. Members, meeting adjourned.
Thank you.